And today we're talking with Dr. Eric Korpela, project scientist with SETI at Home. Hello, Eric. Thanks for joining us today on the program.
You're quite welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Now, Eric, perhaps we can start off by telling the listeners what SETI is all about. What is SETI and what does it stand for?
SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Extraterrestrial intelligence would be life out among the stars. For a long time, people have wondered about life out there, and it's probably been going on since for thousands of years, people telling stories around campfires and looking up at the stars. And we've learned a lot about the nature of stars and planets and what life is and how we got to where we are. So far as we know, there's nothing really unique about the Earth. It's pretty much made of the same stuff as the rest of the universe is. And we're orbiting a star that, well, it's a bit brighter than most, but it's not out of the ordinary. So there are billions of stars like the Sun out there. And if the Earth isn't unusual, why should we be? So are there other civilizations out there? And the only way you can find out is to take a look. And that's where SETI comes in, looking for extraterrestrial civilizations.
So, Eric, what do you think drives the human civilization to search for other intelligent civilizations?
Mainly, it's just another search for the unknown. We've been building a technological civilization here on Earth for the past few thousand years, and I think it's natural for us to ask if we're the only ones in our galaxy or even the universe that are doing this.
So this brings us then to the SETI at Home project. What is SETI at Home?
SETI at Home is a way for people around the world to participate in searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. They can do it by using their home PC. We collect data from the Arecibo Radio Telescope in Puerto Rico, the largest radio telescope in the world. In the past, our SETI group had used specialized machines, essentially supercomputers, purposely built to search for signals in the radio frequency. But they were never really powerful enough to do all the types of analysis that we really wanted to do on the data coming from the radio telescope. We were potentially missing certain types of signals. In the late 90s, when lots of people started coming on the internet, we realized that if we could harness all those computers, we could greatly increase the capacity to search for faint signals. So we designed a screensaver that people could put on their computers that it would contact our website, download a chunk of our data from the radio telescope. It would do a lot of analysis on that data, and then if it found anything, it would send the result back to us, and then it would go and get another chunk of data.
So it's basically like using a huge international network of computers by volunteers who wish to participate in the program.
Yes, and by some measures, SETI at Home is the largest supercomputer in the world, if you include all of those processors that are out there.
So the actual processing platform, Eric, is actually called BOINC, isn't it? B-O-I-N-C, which stands for the Berkeley Open Infrastructure for Network Computing. And that also enables people to process other types of data too, doesn't it?
Yeah, BOINC is something that we developed here a couple of years ago. The development really started. You can, for example, say you look at the list of projects that BOINC supports, you can pick and choose which projects you want to run and what fraction of your computer time you want to donate to each of the projects. For example, you could say, I'd like to donate 50% of my computer time to SETI at home, and 25% to searching for gravitational waves, and another 25% to modeling climate in order to understand global warming. Those are actual projects you can do using Boink, and there are dozens of other projects and more coming online all the time.
Okay, so it basically takes the SETI at home data sent by the SETI at home team to the computers and then processes the data, and then any significant pieces of information it sends back to the SETI at home team for further analysis?
Yeah. So it's not going to be immediately apparent to either the users of SETI at home or even to us whether a specific chunk of data that we sent out has a signal in it. We actually have to do some more processing to be sure. We expect that an extraterrestrial signal will have properties that make it easy to distinguish it between the extraterrestrial signal and perhaps interference due to radio emission from radio transmitters or radars in the vicinity of a telescope.
So what's the actual difference between the SETI at home enhanced version and the classic version, Eric?
So the primary difference between the enhanced version and the older SETI at home versions is there are some optimizations to some of the routines that are run. Meaning that it uses your processor more efficiently. We're not wasting CPU time like older versions might have. We're also doing a finer search. We're searching more possible combinations of signal parameters. So SETI at home itself, actually it would help probably if I described a bit of the process of SETI at home. We essentially have a radio receiver at the Arecibo telescope. Actually, since earlier this year, we have 7 radio receivers, and those receivers are hooked up to data recorders. The receivers are a little different than what your listeners are probably familiar with. For example, a typical home or car receiver allows you to tune into a narrow frequency range, also called the channel, which you could, say, record onto tape or digitize with your computer. That type of receiver is great if the signal's strong or if you know what frequency it's going to come on. But when you're thinking about an extraterrestrial signal, you really don't know what channel ET is going to use. And it's probably going to be pretty faint compared to everything else that's going on around. Like the local radio station is going to be significantly louder than ET would be. So what we do is we record, rather than a specific channel, we record all of the channels or as many channels as we can at once. And then we rely on people's computers to break that data down into the individual channels.
So the receiver would be the multi-band receiver or multi-beam receiver?
Yeah, we both call it the multiband and the multibeam receiver. It's actually known as ALPHA, the Arecibo L-band feed array, but we typically don't use that when talking to the public because not many people know what L-band means.
Mm, sure. If people were wanting to contribute to the SETI at home project, is there any particular computer requirements or do they just download a piece of software?
We try and keep the requirements as minimal as possible. If someone wants to run SETI at home, the first step is to go to our website, http://setiathome.berkeley.edu. Or they can just do a web search on SETI at home. That's probably easier. And on our main page, there will be instructions for how to download the Boink application, which they would install on their computer. And there are instructions there for how to hook up Boink to SETI at home. We try and keep the requirements requirements for the computer itself is as small as we possibly can, too. SETI at home can run in as little as 32 megabytes of RAM, and on operating systems as old as Windows 98. I've got machines that are at least 6 or 7 years old with processors that are 200 megahertz or slower running SETI at home. And they do a reasonable job. Other projects might have more stringent requirements. For example, climate modeling. It would probably be difficult to run a climate model on an old 200 megahertz machine. We have a Macintosh OS X version and a Linux version. And if people are running other operating systems, there's a good chance they'll be able to find a version that was compiled by one of our volunteers. And in the worst case, our source code for the SETI at Home application is available online, and people with the technical skills needed could compile it for themselves.
Yes, I also run SETI at home on a Windows 98 computer that's several years old, so I have no problem doing that at all.
That's good to hear. We do occasionally get some complaints about people with older machines not being able to run SETI at home. Usually it has to do with whether they're able to display the screensaver graphics properly.
Eric, we're talking about the multi-beam receiver. What frequencies are actually monitored at Arecibo for the SETI project?
Well, that's one of the decisions that we have to make in SETI. We can't record every frequency that we would like to. We'd just be overwhelmed by the quantity of data that would result from that. So we have to narrow in on frequencies that we think extraterrestrials might use when they're trying to attract the attention of others. And one likely frequency is at 1.42 gigahertz. At that frequency, hydrogen gas emits radiation. And since hydrogen is the most common element in the universe and it's distributed all through interstellar space, astronomers tend to use that emission to study the structure of the galaxy. So you look at this frequency, you see the hydrogen, and it tells you a lot about what the galaxy is shaped like and the spiral structure of our galaxy. Astronomers everywhere, including on distant planets, should know about this radiation emitted by hydrogen. So if you wanted to attract attention, you send up a flare in a place where you think people are going to be looking. So for that reason, we think it's fairly likely that extraterrestrials that want to talk to us would send a signal near that frequency.
Okay, so 1.42 gigahertz is the natural radio emission of hydrogen, or the hydrogen line, so it's like a marker frequency, if you like.
Yeah, there are also some other frequencies that unfortunately we don't have the capability to observe from Arecibo. There's another line due to the hydroxyl radical, which is an atom of hydrogen and an atom of oxygen joined together. And if you put that together with hydrogen, you get water. And since we're based on water, it's hard to live without it. Maybe extraterrestrials that are based on water might choose this other component of water to send their signal on.
So how's the actual sky searched? Is the Arecibo radio receiving dish pointed to any particular part of the sky at any one time, or does it actually move?
With the new receiver system, our means of observing has changed a bit from what it used to be when we were using a single beam. Once this seven-beam system, looking at seven places in the sky simultaneously, came online, people started using it for systematic surveys of the sky for various reasons. One survey looks for pulsars, which are rapidly rotating, very dense neutron stars. those searches tend to concentrate on the plane of the galaxy. So the galaxy is shaped like a disk, and you expect the neutron stars to be concentrated pretty much the way the stars are in that disk. Well, that's good for us. We can piggyback on that survey, and because that covers where most of the stars are, and that's probably where we would expect to find extraterrestrials. Other surveys are looking for hydrogen, or mapping the hydrogen in the galaxy using that line that we discussed. And I and some other people here are actually taking part in that for the purpose of understanding the hydrogen distribution. But while we're doing that, we might as well simultaneously be looking for extraterrestrials. And there are some other things going on where people are attempting to find nearby small galaxies that probably don't have many stars but still have hydrogen in them. So all of these surveys, well, to some extent, operate at the same time. And the people at Arecibo have come up with a term for this. They call it commensal observing, which derives from the Latin meaning eating from the same table. So essentially, we're all using the same receiver to eat from the table of hydrogen spectra.
So, Eric, has the Parkes Radio Telescope in New South Wales, Australia, contributed to the SETI program at all?
We've often had plans to use it for SETI at home, but none of those plans have come to fruition, predominantly because of the funding situation we've been in. We just haven't had the money to be able to afford the manpower to bring our recorders down there. And it's something that we've wanted to do for a long time. We do have colleagues who have in the past used the Parkes telescope for SETI using our specialized supercomputer type instruments. But we've always wanted to get SETI at home down there. And right now, it doesn't look like it's going to happen in the near future. I still keep my fingers crossed because the Parkes telescope has a similar multi-beam receiver. In fact, the multi-beam receiver that we're using at Arecibo was built in Australia by the people who built the one on the Parkes telescope. Yeah, it's always been on our list of things to do. It would be great because we're really missing half the sky by staying in the Northern Hemisphere. We hope that our Australian colleagues will be able to raise the funds where they could get a SETI at home or even another SETI instrument program going there. But with SETI, it's always difficult to get government and funding agencies interested in the process, and yeah, we've had our struggles here, and our colleagues there have had their difficulties as well.
So hopefully in the future there'll be more monitoring of these frequencies for SETI in the Southern Hemisphere then.
Yeah, it would be very nice to have telescopes all over the world monitoring the entire sky. It doesn't make sense just to concentrate on one part because, you know, we don't know where ET is going to live. It makes sense to cover the entire sky, and we really do need telescopes in the Southern Hemisphere to do so.
Okay, well, there's some technical aspects of the SETI at Home program that people might be interested in finding out more about. For instance, fast Fourier transform. What does that mean, Eric?
Essentially, a fast Fourier transform is a way of breaking the data up into channels, the way I described earlier. So you take a sequence of data as it comes from the telescope, you use a fast Fourier transform to decipher that data and place it into channels by frequency. And in SETI at home, we do a variety of these. The finer you make your frequency bin, the longer the time duration of the bin has to be. It's just a property of the way Fourier transforms work. So if you're looking for short duration signals, you have to use shorter transforms than shorter transforms, meaning fewer channels, than if you are looking for long duration signals. So in SETI at Home, we first divide the data up into 128,000 channels, look for signals in there. If we don't find anything, well, even if we do find something, we then divide it up into 64,000 channels, then again into 32,000 channels, and so on and so forth until we reach 8 channels, which is the fewest channels we look at, but the highest time resolution we get. And when we're looking at these, we call any potential signal that we see in this phase of the analysis, we call them spikes, because if you look at a plot of the amount of power in each channel, a signal will look like one channel being high above the rest, a spike. So one of the big problems that we face in SETI at Home is that you don't really know what a signal is going to be like. We don't know if the signal is going to be transmitted from the surface of a planet or in orbit around a planet. It makes a difference because what's happening to the transmitter actually affects what we see here. If the transmitter is accelerating because a planet is spinning or it's in a satellite in orbit, the accelerations cause the frequency of the signal we receive here to be different and to change due to the Doppler effect. The Doppler effect is similar to what you hear when you hear a train blowing its whistle go by. When it's coming towards you, it appears high-pitched, and going away, it appears low-pitched. Same thing happens with light. And if the transmitter is accelerating, the frequency will change over time. And since we're dividing the spectrum up into channels using these fast Fourier transforms, a drifting signal won't stay in the channel. It would drift out. And in order to recover signals like that, we need to fix that frequency drift. We call the frequency drift chirp because it's kind of like a bird chirp, a whistle that changes in pitch.
So that would be dechirping data?
An extraterrestrial, if they knew where we were and were pointing their telescope at us, they could do this correction for the motion of the transmitter themselves. But if they're broadcasting in all directions and they don't know where the receiving end is, then it's difficult to do the correction on the transmitting end. So we have to do the correction on this side of, in our receiver or in the analysis software. And since we don't know what the motion of the transmitter is, we have to correct for every possible type of motion, within reason. We correct for if the transmitter is sitting on the surface of a planet about the size of the Earth, maybe rotating slower, maybe rotating faster, or in orbit around a planet the size of Earth, or maybe orbiting around a gas giant planet, which would cause fairly extreme accelerations. We don't know which it's going to be, so we have to correct for all possible types of motion. And so the SETI at Home application uses a process called coherent dechirping to correct for that. So when the program starts, it first runs this Fourier transform analysis on the data as it was received, which we call a chirp rate of zero. Then it uses this coherent dechirping to translate the data into a coordinate frame that's accelerating. which usually we start with a very small acceleration. Then it runs the Fourier transform analysis on that chirped data set, or dechirped data set, and then it repeats that in small steps of chirp rate from 0 out to 50 hertz per second, which is pretty much equivalent to how fast the cloud tops in the atmosphere of Jupiter are moving.
So do you have to make any allowances for radio frequency interference?
Yes, we do. There's, you know, just about every chunk of data that we send out comes back with some evidence of intelligence. So far, as far as we can tell, all those examples of intelligence are due to us. We're fairly noisy in the radio, and we generate a lot of interference. We have radars, we have radio stations, we have TV stations, and even though those are designed not to emit where the frequency of the hydrogen line is, there's always some leakage of radio signals into parts of the spectrum where they're not meant to be. So in order to determine whether a signal is actually extraterrestrial or not, we have a few criteria that we have that it needs to meet. One is, if you look at a spot on the sky and see a signal, and then look at some other part of the sky and see the same signal, it's probably not extraterrestrial because you're looking at some other place light years away. Why would you see the same signal? That would identify it as a likely interference signal. A second criteria we use is that an extraterrestrial signal should be persistent. If you come back and look at the same spot on the sky a few days later, you should see a signal at about the same frequency. And we're currently in the process, in the past, we've done these sort of analyses after we've run SETI at home for a couple of years. Then we take all the signals that, potential signals that have been returned. We run what's called a persistency checker on them that both removes these examples that are probably RFI because they appear all over the sky, and identifies places where we see very similar signals at the same spot on the sky.
Perhaps we can explain what the barycentric frequency is.
Yeah, so in order to determine whether two signals are at the same frequency, we have to actually correct the frequency that the client or the SETI at home application calculated for the motions of that transmitter. So we know what frequency we detected the signal at, but in order to determine what signal or what frequency the signal had in interstellar space, we actually have to correct for the motions of the Earth. And in order to do that, we correct to what's called the barycenter of the solar system, which is the center of mass of the solar system, including all the planets. Because the motion of the barycenter should be fairly constant. It shouldn't be accelerated. The only thing that would be accelerating it is the gravitational effects of all the rest of the stars in the galaxy. And that's a pretty small acceleration compared to, say, the motion of the Earth around the Sun, which is a fairly large acceleration. So we go translate the frequency we observed to the frequency we would have observed if we were at the center of mass of the solar system. And those are the frequencies that we compare to one another, because if an extraterrestrial is transmitting, we expect that they will be transmitting at a relatively constant frequency. So regardless of what motion the Earth is doing at any specific time, the frequency when translated to the barycenter of the solar system should be the same.
Now, another technical term used in SETI at home is Gaussian. What does Gaussian mean, Eric?
doing our fast Fourier transform analysis, we also look at how the signal in any one channel varies over time. And the main way we expect things to vary is if when we're looking at, if we're not looking and staring at a point on the sky, but if our field of view is drifting across the sky, we expect that an extraterrestrial source, as it comes into our field of view, will first start out faint, get brighter as it nears the center, and then as it passes through the field of view, it will get fainter again. And the shape of the curve, if you plot the strength of the signal over time, would look like what's a bell-shaped curve, which is known as a Gaussian, named after Gauss, who was a fairly famous mathematician, famous enough that he's on, I can't remember which euro note, but he's on the money in Europe that counts as famous in my book. So if we see something that has a close match to one of these Gaussian curves, that would be a good indication that we've seen an extraterrestrial signal.
So what about the cost of the project, of the SETI at Home project, Eric, and how is it funded?
Well, our project is pretty lean as a whole. We've got three part-time scientists and four part-time programmers, and that's primarily because of our budget. We kind of are limited by our budget into what we can do and how quickly we can do it. If we could change some of those part-timers to full-timers or increase the percentage of their salary that we pay, we could accomplish more and do it more quickly. To keep our computers running and repair things that break and pay for our internet access and such things costs us about $400,000 annually. To keep advancing, developing new things, putting new receivers on, probably would, well, our goal is to raise between $500,000 and $750,000 per year to keep things advancing. And the closer we get to that $750,000, the more likely it is we'll be able to employ enough people that they can build enough equipment that we could bring it to, say, the Parkes Observatory. We're nearly entirely funded by donations from our volunteers at this point. Government funding has been hard to come by. We've gotten grants to develop instruments, primarily because the instruments that we develop are good for more than just SETI. We developed the radio spectrometers that two of the other Arecibo groups, observing hydrogen and observing extragalactic clouds, are using. But so far, the government has not seen fit to fund the actual observations and our analysis and keeping our computers running. So we've turned to our participants. We had a fund drive this spring, which was quite successful. We raised $250,000. We're planning to start another fund drive probably at the beginning of next month. And we hope we can reward the generosity of our volunteers with an improved SETI at home.
Yes, well, Eric, there's a quote on your website from Arthur C. Clarke, and he says, SETI is probably the most important quest of our time, and it amazes me that governments and corporations are not supporting it sufficiently.
Yes. When we were planning our spring fund drive, we asked Arthur C. Clarke to lend us his support in that drive, and that was the first thing that he said in his letter responding in the affirmative to being willing to help draft a letter for us to send to our donors, I agree. It is amazing to me that SETI is in some cases almost looked on with derision by even other astronomers. And it would be nice if the government would support us in our endeavor.
Well, what do you think of the chances of finding intelligent civilizations?
There's an equation called the Drake equation that you can use to estimate the number of communicating extraterrestrial civilizations in the galaxy and beyond. And that equation includes terms like the number of stars formed in our galaxy every year, what fraction of those stars have planets, what fraction of planets develop life, and so on. And as we learn more about stars and planets and life, I plug in what my best guess for the numbers and the values of those parameters are and see what numbers pop out. And the last time I did that, which was about a year ago, I was teaching a course at the time, I came to the conclusion that there was somewhere between one civilization for every 2.5 million stars. And there are 200 billion stars in the galaxy, so that would be a lot of civilizations in the galaxy. So that was the high end of my estimate. The low end of my estimate was that there might be as few as one civilization per 2 million galaxies. That's
wow.
a large range.
It is a large range.
Yeah, so maybe there are 750,000 civilizations in our galaxy, or maybe we need to search through 2 million external galaxies in order to find another civilization. At the high end, we'll probably find one in the next couple of decades. At the low end, we'll probably never find one. So I'm pretty confident the answer is somewhere in there.
So, Eric, what do you think the ramifications would be for human civilization if an extraterrestrial intelligent signal was found?
Well, the first ramification is how people would react, and I've never been very good at predicting such things. I'm sure there would be profound implications on a sociological level. The first question the people of the world will ask themselves are fairly obvious. Who are they, what are they saying, and should we reply? And the answer to those questions will probably take years to come by. The first detection of an extraterrestrial signal will probably just be a beacon. We'll have to spend a lot of time searching for meaning in that beacon. And there are mechanisms in place. The UN actually has agreements for what to do about the question of replying. But given the preponderance of technology in the world and the availability of, say, satellite dishes, I'm not sure that they can control the answer to the question, should we reply. Chances are that someone probably will. Just take it upon themselves to reply. A lot of people have theorized that finding ET would have a large effect on the religions of the world, but I'm not sure that the effect would be all that large. Religions, by and large, have had to incorporate new information into how they view the world before, and I'm sure that will continue. Sometimes it takes a few hundred years for them to catch up. But I really don't see that it will shatter the faith of too many people. But the largest potential impact would be if we can start a dialogue with extraterrestrials. That may not be possible. It's hard to know at this point. They may be so different from us that communication beyond telling each other that we understand mathematics is impossible. But it would be great to know what the basis of their biology is, what molecule are they based on? Is it like DNA or is it something entirely different? What is their understanding of physics? Do they know more about physics than we do? Do they have a means of traveling through between the stars? That would be nice to know. And what level is their technology at? Have they come up with solutions to problems that we face, for example, energy supplies and such? I don't really hold hope that they will solve all our problems, as some people have hoped, but I think there are a lot of interesting questions that our understanding of the answers to we can share with each other.
Yes, well, given the vast distances across the universe, Eric, I guess one of the challenges would be getting the signal there, given that it would take probably, you know, thousands of years to get a signal to the nearest star system.
Yes, we'd have to be very patient. And there's always the possibility that by the time we sent our reply, the civilization that was running the beacon might not actually be there anymore. We don't know how long civilizations last and whether they have the attention span to wait 1,000 years for a reply to a message. There's really, as far as we know, no way around the speed of light limitation. If we're going to communicate, we really need to be patient. And patient as a species, because this is well beyond patience that an individual would have. No individual can be patient for 1,000 years. But I'm hoping that as a civilization we can be patient for that long.
So what about the future of SETI at home, Eric? What's on the horizon?
Well, we've got a number of developments that we're working on. We recently installed our recorder on the multibeam receiver. We're in the process of developing the application that will analyze that data and the server-side components that we need. I'm hopeful that those will be going into our beta project around the beginning of November. And when I'm not doing interviews, I'm working on the server side and the client side parts of that. Longer term, we have some other projects. The way we've been searching so far, extraterrestrials, we're hoping will decide that the best way to attract attention is to concentrate their signal into a short or a narrow frequency range. That way it will stand up above the noise. But it's just as valid for extraterrestrials to pack all their power into a short time duration, but a wide frequency range. And no one has really done a search for that type of signal yet. And we're working on something called AstroPulse. It's also been in the works for quite a while. We lost our original graduate student who was working on it. He decided that he liked pulsars better. We're hopeful that that will start coming out into the beta project probably around the beginning of next year. And so AstroPulse will look for short-duration pulses, either from extraterrestrial civilizations. There are these phenomena called giant pulses that occur on pulsars. They might also show up. Whether you call this more speculative than extraterrestrial sending pulses, there is the possibility that evaporating black holes might give off a short duration radio pulse, and AstroPulse would be able to detect those as well.
So in the meantime, Eric, you'd be encouraging as many people as possible to support the program by either donating or downloading the program so they can help SETI at home.
Yes, in fact, with the 7-beam receiver, actually it's misleading to call it 7 beams because it's actually generating 14 times as much data as our original SETI at home receiver. And because of that, we're actually going to be in the situation where we don't have enough volunteers to analyze the data as fast as it comes in. So we're hoping to be able to ramp up the number of people we have running SETI at home in the next few months, that way we'll be able to keep up with the rate that data comes in.
So what are the other future plans for other SETI-type projects other than SETI at home? Is there anything else on the horizon?
There's a lot on the horizon for SETI. In our group alone, we've been building these instruments that, the first one was called Serendip, which stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Radio Emissions from Nearby Developed Indigenous Populations. That's a mouthful. So the first one was Serendip 1, followed by Serendip 2. Late last year, we turned off our Serendip 4 receiver, which was at Arecibo, and we're in the process of building one that's called Serendip 5. So we're in the process of putting our Serendip 5 spectrometer on the Arecibo telescope, and it will analyze a much wider band path than SETI at home alone can. Whereas SETI at home records 2.5 megahertz, the Serendip 5 instrument will record 100 megahertz simultaneously from any of the receivers and has the capability to step in frequency, so it can move in to cover a wider band than it would if it were in at one stable frequency. So that's actually fairly near term. We're hoping to have that come online early in the next year. Further on the horizon are some large telescope arrays. The Allen Telescope Array, which is located here in California, is an array of several hundred small dishes scattered in a not quite random pattern. The signals from all these dishes will be combined so as to add up properly that it looks at one point on the sky, even though the beams of the individual telescopes cover a large area of sky. And by adding more and more electronics, you can basically electronically make additional beams and look multiple places on the sky. And so that is currently early in its development. They have about 30 dishes online. So the Allen Telescope Array is in the early stages of its development. They have about 30 or so dishes installed, and more will be coming online over the years. I believe it's in the 3 to 4 year time scale before it comes online fully, and its collecting area will be about the equivalent of what the Arecibo telescope is. Further in the future, there's what's known as the Square Kilometer Array, also called the SKA. The goal for the Square Kilometer Array is to have a square kilometer of collecting area and as many dishes as are required for that. There are various competing proposals on how to build the dishes, how big the dishes should be, and where to place them. Of course, I'm an astronomer, so I want a square kilometer array to be in the northern hemisphere and one to be in the southern hemisphere so I can see the whole sky. But first they'll build one. They have not yet chosen the site, as far as I know. And both of these arrays will be phenomenal instruments for SETI use, primarily because by adding these things that allow you to create new beams, new spots on the sky where the telescope is looking simultaneously, you can be using the same telescope for a large number of different observations at the same time. That means that we can do our SETI observations without bothering the people who want to search for pulsars. We can look where we want to look as opposed to where everyone else of collecting power, and will allow us to do even more sensitive observations.
So some of the data collected from the SKA project, will that be analyzed through the SETI at Home project as well?
The Square Kilometer Array will probably not come online for a decade or so. I certainly hope that SETI at Home is still in existence when the Square Kilometer Array comes online. And I hope that, well, given that everyone's computers will be so much faster, I think we'll be able to do amazing things with data no matter which telescope it comes from at that point.
Now, if anybody would like to log into the website, that's at setiathome.berkeley.edu.
And SETI at Home on your favorite search engine will do the job just as well.
Well, thanks very much for joining us today, Eric. It's been most interesting talking with you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Dr. Eric Korpela, project scientist with SETI at Home.